Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Asia Society, World Trade Club, and Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the World Trade Center on the shores of San Francisco Bay. I am Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome our radio listeners joining us for today's program. And now, here to introduce our special guest is Dr. Marshall Bouton, Executive Vice President of the Asia Society. Marshall?
Thank you very much, Skip. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is my great privilege on behalf of the Society and the other organizers to welcome you all here today and to introduce our speaker, Ambassador Joseph W. Prier, Ambassador of the United States to the People's Republic of China. Let me say first how pleased we are to have this opportunity to work once again with the Commonwealth Club and the World Trade Club. As many of you know, the Asia Society has only recently established its Northern California office, and we hope by being here to benefit from and to contribute to the extraordinary connections which this part of our country has had historically and has today, of course, to Asia. We are committed to collaborating with organizations in San Francisco and more widely in Northern California for this purpose. I want to introduce our Vice President for Pacific Coast Activities, Gary Larson, who's here with us today from a city to the south, who shouldn't be named, I guess, in San Francisco, Gary, and Pam Joyce, who directs our Northern California office. I hope, by the way, that many of you will be able to attend the Society's annual corporate conference this May, which will take place in Shanghai. The theme of the conference is how to compete in the new economy. We are very pleased and privileged to announce that the Chinese Premier, Zhu Rongji, has accepted our invitation to open the conference, and we expect an extraordinary event which will review how China is, along with other Asian nations, are responding to the challenges that a global economy is bringing to all of us. I want also to introduce the representative of the People's Republic of China here in Northern California, Consul General Wang Yuzhang. Ambassador Wang, please stand up. He's been here only 6 months, he told me, but I could tell he's already well acclimatized to the Bay Area. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no challenge for American foreign policy in the 21st century greater than that of forging a long-term constructive relationship with the People's Republic of China, a relationship which advances American interests, indeed our shared interests, in the peace, stability, and prosperity of the Asia-Pacific region. Ambassador Prier, therefore, today holds one of the most sensitive and important diplomatic assignments in the world today. And he represents President Clinton there at what is clearly a critical time for U.S.-China relations. The U.S. Congress will decide this spring whether to approve permanent normal trade relations with China and so to facilitate China's entry into the World Trade Organization. The recent Chinese white paper has raised anew concerns in Washington and elsewhere about the potential for conflict in the Taiwan Straits. So this is a very sensitive time, and we are very fortunate that Ambassador Prier has taken literally a few hours out of a busy schedule en route back to China to be with us. He brings to this assignment an extraordinary set of credentials. His highly distinguished career of 35 years in the United States Navy was capped by his service as Commander-in-Chief in the Pacific Command from 1996 to 1999. In that post, he dealt with a wide range of issues and leaders in the Asia-Pacific region. He has also served as Commander of the U.S. Mediterranean Fleet and as Vice Chief of Naval Operations. The United States is fortunate to have Ambassador Prier representing the President and our nation in China at this important time. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Joseph Prier.
Well, I thank you for that introduction, and it's great to be back in the Bay Area again. And you all have a good vantage point. You can be forgiven for gazing out the window where the view might be a little more attractive than some other spots. The last time I was here was in November, and I was at a, for those who are junkies on Washington policies and confirmations, I was between the confirmation and the vote, so it was sort of a delicate time. And I begged off of all the hard questions. Orville was monitoring the questions. I begged off because I certainly can't answer those questions. Well, I haven't changed the second part of that, but I'll have to find some new excuses for today that because I still don't know the answer to some of them. But it's great to be here. I thank the Asia Society and the Commonwealth Club and the World Trade Club for sponsoring this event and allowing us to get together. I also am grateful for the weather, which I presume called out the people that just wanted to go downtown for a lunch and have people that are generally interested in the U.S.-China relationship. For those of you that may have a pressing engagement, what I would like to do is in just about, I think, a minute and a half, give you all of what I'm going to say today, and then I'll elaborate on it some. What I'm accustomed to doing is making some unsupported assertions, but since and then we usually getting into it in question and answer period. But since we're doing this on the radio, and for the record, sometimes these unsupported assertions don't play as well as they might, and we can spend weeks trying to clean up the mess after a misstatement of some sort. But the message today is one that is. It is fairly simple. First, our country, the United States, and China have strategic objectives that have a great deal of congruence, and certainly the issues that we have in common, the objectives we have in common, far outweigh the problem areas that we have. Second, a workable U.S.-China relationship, one that doesn't have to be just perfect, but one that is workable where we have good dialogue, is essential to solving these issues and to getting there toward these strategic objectives, which are of interest to both of us. Third, China, essentially since the end of the Cultural Revolution, and many in this group know, is in the period of great change. They are changing very rapidly, and they're changing in many aspects. The United States, our government, can influence these changes. They cannot control these changes, but they can have a great influence, and we also have a great stake in the outcome. And the way that I think our nation needs to proceed is, on the one hand, with a great deal of strength, which we have, and perseverance, and on the other hand, a respect for the difficulties and the challenges that face all other nations, in fact, but also, in this case, particularly face China. Now, that's it. You can go now. But my disclaimer, and Marshall got at it a little bit in the introduction, I've spent 35 years working on the security interests of the United States. The way I see my job right now is a continuing effort in the security interests of the United States. And what happens so frequently, and I think Ambassador Wong, who is an old hand, he's been here 6 months. I've been in my post 3. So, but as I continue to work on the interests of the United States, people understand that. But in this case, we have to reconcile the interests of our host nation, China, with those of the United States, and see where the differences are and see where the areas of similarity lie. And so part of what we are trying to do is to create more understanding. I think the people of the United States who do not travel to China, and some that do, don't understand China, and I'm not saying I do either. But also the people in China don't understand the United States. Probably scholars in both countries understand a little more, but that's not necessarily the people that make the decisions. Now, we have many issues that compete for our attention right now. The issue of Taiwan is between the United States and China is a issue of immense proportions. Marshall mentioned the white paper. We have a trade deficit. We have rhetoric on a variety of topics. Some of it is quite strident. We have PNTR, all of those things that are going on. What I'd like to do today is try to give a little bit of a backdrop and give some perspective for weighing the importance of those things. If the sign of intelligence is to be able to distinguish what is important from what's unimportant, it's key to understanding China to try to see what are the big things in this relationship and what are the little things that are just ripples along the way. And so that's what I would like to focus on today as I go forward. First, let's look a little bit at the common interests. And this is something where I'm not going to go in great detail. But our common interests lie in four areas. One, in the region, stability in Northeast Asia, Russia, India. The United States and China have a common interest in having all of these relationships be in balance. Second, there are a bunch of global issues, the environment, food, things like that, that are of common interest to us. And China, with about 23% of the population in the world, these issues will not get solved without China being a part of the solution. So we need to work together with them on those subjects as well. There are hot spots. The Korean Peninsula and Taiwan are the two that are critical right now. And both the United States and China have a strong interest in having these be resolved in a peaceful and useful way. And then there are international issues that have to do with rules of law, human rights, weapons proliferation. There are all the gamut of international issues that exist where China and the U.S. have a common interest. We need to work on these things together. We need to have some systems and foundations and some understanding and trust so that we can work out these issues, and that's what we're trying to work on. Now, first consider the role and the position of the United States. The United States is very well blessed through the efforts of a lot of people and also with natural blessings. Most of us, I'm looking around there, I don't think anybody was here at the creation, but most of us that were in the United States were here because we were born here or we came here. We're very fortunate. The United States is a country that has secure borders. It's got Canada to the north. It's got Mexico to the south. It's got oceans on the east and west. During the growth of the United States, as the United States grew from the east to the west, we were largely left alone by other countries to do this on our own. The United States has an economy whose robustness and vigor is manifest, and I won't go into that. But we also have a military that is the strongest in the world. Though it needs focus, it can go anywhere and do the bidding of our country that we need to do. We also have a government that is responsive. It is a government that is visible and transparent, and it is a government that is accountable to the people. We have an election going on right now. It's a great manifestation of this. I could go on and on. We have a population and resource match, which is very good. We have a lot of things going for us in the United States, and we play a very strong hand. We have a hand that's about four aces. We have a very strong hand to play. We also have an opportunity in the world to influence things well and to use this position of comprehensive strength that we have to use this to make things work a little better. And we must not squander this opportunity through inattention, through arrogance, or through carelessness. We need to keep our eye on the ball. Now, if we contrast what I've just described about the United States to China, China has a number of challenges that are also clear to a lot of us. A marvelous culture, a marvelous civilization, ages old, is something that we can all admire. And so if we look at some of the challenges that face China, what does it mean to have 1.25 to 1.3 billion people? Ambassador Wong, I've been looking for the person in China that has the answer on what that number is. But say about 1.27 billion people. What does that mean? Ken Lieberthal, who is starting to claim to be an academician again, but he is on the National Security Council, has a word image he uses to describe what it means to have 1.27 billion people. If you're sitting in Washington, and I apologize being here on the West Coast, but I've been brainwashed a little bit in the last few days. But if you're sitting in Washington and you've got a country about the size of the United States and you've got 1.27 billion people, you have four or five to each one in the United States, and 80% of them are east of the Mississippi River. You have a water people mismatch where there's plenty of water in the south and plenty of people in the north, but something's going to have to get reconciled with that mismatch in the next 15 years. Where the United States has Canada, a peaceful neighbor, a peaceful border, China has Russia. Where we have California, we get out into Xinjiang, we go to the south, and there's India, and we don't have a fertile, productive, and certainly not another coastline there. If we go to Martha's Vineyard and places off the East Coast where people go on vacations, there we have Korea and Japan, who in the past have been traditional enemies of China's. And so there, and if we look further to the south, there's Vietnam, and then Burma, Cambodia, along the southern part of China. It's a very challenging environment and very different from the one we face. A couple of contrasts that are sort of fun to think about, I believe, and we are consumed, those of us who deal with Washington a lot, with beltway issues. And the beltway issues in the United States, I hope you don't care too much about them here. You care about a few of them. But inside the beltway, everybody focuses in very hard on them. Well, Beijing has ring roads. They have ring road issues, too, I think. Some issues are very important in Beijing, but when you get to the hinterlands, they're much less important than the ones that exist inside. Winston Lord, who is a predecessor in China and the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the State Department and now lives in New York, wrote a treatise, and he gives a speech. He uses his name and says, "I am the Lord. These are the Ten Commandments." I'm trying to figure out how prayer can work into something like that, but I can't get it yet. But okay. Jot that down, would you? His Ten Commandments are. It's actually a pretty good pitch that he has. But his first one is don't demonize China, and his second one is don't sanitize China, and his point is that. Everything, when you study the culture and the civilization of China and you all these things that are romanticized, they're true. They're true about China. There are wonderful things. And then when people that tend to demonize China and say some things that there have been some oppressive events that have occurred in the government, certainly by our standards, and there are some things that we don't like, those things are true too. It is such a complex country that almost anything you can say about it is true. We can look in the mirror on that from time to time ourselves. There's another insight, and these are, I don't know, these things make some difference to me. They may not to you. But we were with a legal scholar, Madame Julie Long, in Shanghai, sitting around talking about the rule of law and building a legal structure and the judicial structure in China, and we're trying to make some generalizations about it. And every time we made a generalization, she smiled in the most polite way and said, "Yes, yes, that's true in part, but it's not really quite that way." And I think that if you can use that as a generalization about China, that seems to be right to me too. Nothing is quite the way it seems on the surface. Let me give you a couple of other just examples, and I won't dwell on this too much in the interest of time, but if you look at how China is progressing, in Beijing, I've been going there since the fall of 99, and traffic actually has gotten better in Beijing. There were the mix of bicycles and various conveyances and now large black limousines which abound in Beijing, they all sort of work with bicycle rules in a way. The only really common theme you can find is I was here first. And working around Beijing is very difficult. But the other day we were at an intersection, and I was in my car with Mr. Shao, my driver, and there were about five or six large black cars all snarled up in traffic, and we couldn't get through the intersection. It was down by Tiananmen Square on Zhongnanmen Y. And when you got up to see where the problem was, which you couldn't see from back in the queue, there were four pedicabs, little three-wheel pedicabs. One had coal, one had chickens, and one had some plastic bags, and I don't remember what the other one had. But they were up there quarreling over the right-of-way. And so they had everything. But it's the juxtaposition of those two things is a good idea of some of the challenges that China is facing right now. The businesses in China range from fairly large businesses where the U.S. partner deals with a handshake with his Chinese partner, and things go well. The company is making a profit. They are moving ahead. They trust each other. They can do business by word of mouth, and they're good for their word, and that's the ideal circumstance. Then there are other situations where very large companies are in various provinces, and they feel like they're throwing money down a hole. They feel like they're getting ripped off at every turn, and in some cases they feel like that the laws are biased against them or investigations are biased against them. So it runs the gamut from the good to the bad, and it also changes a great deal depending on what province and what locality you're in. There's a great variation. There's another issue and a contrast where the crackdown by the Chinese government on the Falun Gong is something I don't understand fully. But that coexists with increasing worship services that are going on around Beijing and around the country, and they are not they are organized to a small degree, but people are free to express their views in private. They're free to worship, and this balance is something. It's a set of contrasts that are yet to be worked out, and they are things that are in work right now. So some of the challenges China faces, the official unemployment statistics are about 3%. Most estimates are around 10%, maybe higher. Income disparity. The average income in Shanghai, a marvelous city, is about 12 times what the average rural income is. This is something that is being thought about and worked on by the Zhu Rongji and the people working on finances in China. Corruption is a major issue in China. There is a corruption scandal in Xiamen that is going on now, which has tentacles that are reaching out both into the government and into other provinces as well. And by most polls, corruption is the foremost aspect of things that bother young people in China as they try to move forward. Conversion of the state-owned enterprises. The state-owned enterprises, this is a separate subject in itself, but they were not designed to make a profit. They were designed to produce and also to provide jobs and take care of people. So as they try to convert to privatization, it's a very difficult path for them and something that is creating a lot of strain. Rural to urban migration. The things that most of us read about in China and the progress is along the coastline with about 300 million people. The other 800 to 900 million people are inland. And there is the income disparity and also the quality of life disparity between the rural people and those in the urban areas. There's a lack of infrastructure in China. They're trying to build this. There's gas in the west. There's not infrastructure to get it to the east. Bad bank loans exist. This is something that estimates run from 30 to 50% bad bank loans, an onerous thing for any government to handle. And then there's a dedicated but a somewhat outmoded military, which has some of the smartest and most patriotic people I've met working for it. So what we're looking at is China's system, both the party and the state, are grappling with all of these issues, and change is occurring in China. The change is really in three ways. Change first is the one that we see the most, which is the economy, going from a centralized, planned, controlled economy, a totalitarian economy, shifting to an open market and a diverse economy. And this is one that is in progress. It's in work right now. The second change is a rule of individuals, going back to the emperors and the warlords, but then to the party, which is shifting to a bit of a rule of law. Now, I would like not to overstate this change. It is occurring at a slow rate, but it is occurring. And when you talk about rule of law, I think it means different things to different people. To me, for a while, I kept thinking about it in one context, but it has several. To a businessman, it really has to do with economic restructuring. Are there rules, regulations, a pattern in which you know what the ground rules are before you go into a business arrangement? Or are the rules shifting all the time? That's what rule of law means in that context. And can you get a fair hearing when you have a dispute? To someone for whom human rights is the main issue, and frequently there are people for whom both of these are big issues, are the individual rights protected against the state, or the state protected against individual rights? That is a shift that is occurring, and I don't want to say that it's going too fast. The third change is going from a closed society, an inward-looking society, to an open society participating in global commerce and in global politics. So this change can be evolutionary and it can be productive, or it could be sudden and be very destructive, and we have a way of being able to perhaps influence it. But it's in the U.S. interest and in China's interest that this change occur in the former way, where it evolves and is a constructive change. So what we need to do is we need to look at this and look at the ways that we can influence this change. And what we seek is a China that becomes more a responsible global neighbor with whom we and other nations deal well and deal in a structure and in a situation of trust. The alternative to that is to have a situation in which there is confrontation and there's uncertainty at every turn in our dealings with this nation that has just a little less than 250,000 of the people in the world. And our interest, remember, is in a stable, secure, and a prosperous China. So now, I said at the outset, what can we do about this? What can we do in the United States? I had an interesting discussion in an airport in Shenyang with a young man. The plane was a little late, and he asked, what's the difference between manifest destiny and the Middle Kingdom? And this wasn't on my talking point, so I didn't. But it's the gist of the conversation was pretty interesting. And the gist of it is both of our countries think we're pretty important. Both of us think that we have a special place in the world. And so this brings us into conflict from time to time, this notion. And it is something we have to recognize. And I will every now and then I catch myself, but I don't do it often. But the point about this is for the United States, in influencing a change in China, helping China to change and overcome some of these hurdles, which are in our interest to do, how do we do this? It is not by saying, gee, China, if only you were more like us, things would be just fine. We don't particularly respond well to that opening gambit with people. It is, I think, by trying to, as objectively as we can, talking about the characteristics of nations that are successful in the world today, that have sustained success. What are they? We want China to have sustained success. They want to have sustained success. There are eight characteristics that nations have, and they're similar to what you used to study in school about the elements of power, but they're a little different in the modern world. But the eight characteristics are: they have open markets. Successful nations have open markets. They have a free flow of information. They have a responsive government that is transparent and accountable to the people. They have a respect for human rights. They have a rule of law, the heartbeat of a civil society. They have an independent judiciary. They have secure borders. And then they have what the buzzword is: free and fair elections. They have, and all of these things are to one degree or another. The basic part of a free and fair election is there's a choice of some sort in that. So those are the characteristics to which I think China should aspire, and that we need, through whatever influence we can have, to try to assist them to get there in a as graceful a way as we can. Now, I don't think the path of change for China will be necessarily smooth. Change incurs some turbulence. But when we talk about a stable nation, this gets back into engineering, and you think about stable systems a little bit, if you'll excuse me. But if it's that bad, I'll go on with another line. But stable, we take some grief when we talk about looking for stable. That means it's interpreted that the United States wants things to be in the status quo. That's not what stability means. What it means is a system, a government, or a system that works on a sine curve. It ebbs and flows, but there are things that tend to restore it towards stability, and the excursions from a norm are not too great. So that's what we mean. Change has to occur, but it occurs in a way that is controllable and works well. So as we look forward, as we go for our work with China and we deal with strength and respect, what are the things we can do? We should support economic reform in China. We should support rule of law reform in China. We should try to engage China in a human rights dialogue. And this doesn't mean, I think we'll have some luck with this, it doesn't mean you listen to our lectures on human rights. It means to have a dialogue where we have a common problem that we need to solve, you and us together, and let's talk about it. That's what I think is a productive human rights dialogue. Same thing on weapons proliferation in the world. We need to look at ourselves and look at other nations, but include China in this dialogue and also in arms control. And then down to the issue that is at point right now is the issue of accession to the World Trade Organization, which I think is very important in influencing change in China. Now, the economic benefits of joining WTO for China, or having China included in WTO, are manifest. The benefits to the United States are manifest. There are short-term benefits that will be accrued as soon as China joins up. And then there are long-term ones that will take a long time, perhaps decades, to fully implement. But there are many agreements where there will be some short-term gains for the United States as well as for China. China, in order to move ahead in the global economy, needs to work with international standards, so it's clearly in their long-term interest to join the WTO, but it'll create some short-term problems for them as well. But WTO and this opening, this economic opening to the rest of the world, has impact in the political sphere, and it also has impact in the security sphere as well. So as we look at the other things going on, the white papers, the issue with Taiwan. I haven't talked much about Taiwan. Perhaps I'll get to in the questions and answers. But as we look at the other issues that are going on, right now a immense piece that enables our relationship with China to move forward is their successful accession to the WTO. And for the arrangement that Charlene Parcheski worked out with China, this means permanent normal trade relations. This is our commitment to that part of the agreement in order to get access to China's markets. So I've tried to talk about some of the overall relationship, the strategic objectives, and then right now I hope close is a vote on WTO, and I hope that you all will support that in every arena that you get a chance to. Thanks very much for your time, and I'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Joseph Prier, U.S. Ambassador to China, for your remarks to us this afternoon. And now, Mr. Ambassador, you are so right. We have plenty of questions. So if you join me back here at the podium, we'll begin.
All right.
First question. China has moved much closer to capitalism over the last decade. What have been the implications, in your opinion, of this move towards freer markets?
Well, the move toward capitalism is something I let me give a little preamble statement about the how much this is related, and I'm eventually going to draw it back. How much my wife and I enjoy living in China, and this has to do with the pleasure of being with the people of China. Now, probably somewhat like our government, it's not always a treat. In dealing with them. But dealing with the people, it's a lot of fun, a sense of humor. And what I was getting around to is a strong entrepreneurial spirit that exists in China as well. And they're very good businessmen and businesswomen. So China's move toward capitalism, I think, is something that has opened their markets. It has generated capital and allowed China to move forward in the last 20 years. It has allowed them to become an influence in the world instead of not having enough finances in order to generate capital, in order to do things in the world. It has opened China to the outside world and has also opened the outside world to many, many Chinese. So I think the impacts are, you know, are certainly economic and capital generation. I think they are forcing... It is a forcing function that is forcing China to play in the world at large, and I think that's good, though it won't be trouble-free. And the other part is now China is worrying, just like we do, about the income distribution part of the economic system, which is will be a challenge to China as it is to other nations.
What are the prospects China, as a non-market economy, being admitted to the WTO, and what problems remain before that can happen?
Well, China is there in our WTO agreement with China. There are some 150 with each with subsets of agreements on. Particulars of types of economic change that will have to occur. China's opening their markets and signing up with to access to WTO means they will have to make tremendous changes in the way they do business, in tariff structure. There will have to be some continuity from both the central government and in the provinces and also in the localities for businesses that from outside that work in China. I don't think joint ventures will go away, but the 51% ownership will be a piece that will probably most likely change. I think there'll be some wholly owned foreign companies in China. Agricultural agreements are very important, and we look at China as the number one producer of corn and wheat in the world, and number two or three in cotton. I'm not sure about that. But the distribution of food and the distribution of agricultural products will change as they enter the world flow. So all of these things will have a great impact. And quite frankly, I, along with many of my other people, am not smart enough to know what all these impacts are going to be. I don't know exactly how these will play out, but I'm sure that they'll play out in a long-term positive way.
Mr. Ambassador, as a follow-up to that last question, this questioner asks, when China is a member of WTO, will it still need most favored nation status? Is that status allowed under WTO?
The most favored nation was the name of that was changed to normal trade relations because it was the norm that our country had with other nations. So the PNTR, permanent normal trade relations, is equals most favored nation, and they will have that status, and that it will once if our Congress approves it, and it would continue under WTO. But it's really a misnomer. It's really a misnomer. It's not most favored nation. It's normal trade that we have with the other nations with whom we trade.
A question on your operations in China. How elaborate is the American mission in China? How many consulates? How large a staff is there? Is it difficult to manage the operations?
Somebody's serving up fungos here. We got to try to answer it objectively. We have four consulates. Prior to 1949, we had 14 consulates. We have a consulate in Beijing, and then we have four additional ones. But we have in Shanghai, Guangzhou, Sichuan, and Shenyang, we have consulates. And we have a fifth one approved, but the climate isn't right for opening a fifth one right now. Well, that's next year's project. But the other part that I talked about, the fungo issue, is something our embassy, its facilities, are an embarrassment to the United States in China. We are in an embassy that Pakistan turned down in 1972, along in that period. The business practices and the facilities are just they're really third world. And so this is something that's a big issue for me. I knew this before I came. And we're working really hard on this with the Congress and with the State Department and moving this along to try to get a facility of which we can be proud and also will be a staging ground so we can operate with a successful nation a decade from now when other countries have modern, capable facilities. So ours is not up to snuff, and likewise the Chinese facilities in the United States are in Washington are not what they would like to have. They're among their for major nations. It's not what they would like to have in the U.S. And we're trying to solve these things concurrently, as you might imagine. So managing it right now, it is certainly not an unmanageable task. But the business practices are so ancient and slow that it makes it a little difficult. Now, what I'd like to say in counterbalance to that is the people that are there are absolutely marvelous. We have some of the brightest, most committed and dedicated people that make it work in spite of some of these shortcomings. And they work very hard and make it work. And the environment in Beijing is different than a lot of other places, and some things are harder to do. But the State Department people and the people from Department of Commerce and the agriculture and the immigration service and all the others, they are doing a great job. It's not their issue. It's just that we have neglected the infrastructure to an extent that it's unsatisfactory. Thank you. Bet you didn't expect that when you answered that question.
Business, understandably, wants to locate factories where labor costs are cheap. But how can consumers ensure that workers and artisans are paid a living wage?
That's anytime you get words like ensure in there, that's a hard question to answer for sure. But the part of the influence of U.S. companies, and I can name, you know, some of the big companies that have been there a long time, and I know I'll leave out a few that are doing a great job, but one of the more visible places is the General Motors plant that's in Shanghai, where they've got $1.5 billion invested there. But also the business practices and the labor standards are very high. Other companies that are I'll try to stay out of talking about companies but of the names of companies. But the companies that we have there and are held by themselves really to a high standard, but they are providing an example of how we do business and how one ought to do business, and they can, in a sense, be a beacon. That's not to say that they're all really great. There are, you know, by and large, they are, and there are companies large and small that are providing very good examples. And our commercial service people and our other foreign service personnel cross-check these companies in China to make sure they're working up to both China's standards and ours.
Mr. Ambassador, as you might expect, we have numerous questions on the China-Taiwan situation, so we'll start off with several of these. The first questioner wants to know, what can and should we expect on any kind of resolution to the China-Taiwan problem?
Let me try to give a general answer on the or description of the Taiwan issue, and then not get into every detail of every question. First, in order to open up relations with China, President Nixon moved to recognize that there was one China, and this occurred, and then the Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, and we recognize that there is one China. We recognize that there are issues between Taiwan and China, and the Taiwan Relations Act does not say commitment, but I think if you looked at the mood of our Congress, you'd say that there is a commitment to peaceful resolution of the differences between China and Taiwan. Now, on China's side of this issue, the issue of Taiwan is a core sovereignty issue for China. Taiwan is part of China. I think the Chinese would really like to have a peaceful resolution of this issue. As a sovereign right, they will not eschew the use of force. If you look at it in sort of an academic issue, if someone asked the United States to take out use of force of our repertoire for solving something, just probably on principle, we would not do it. But I think that it is a very, very sensitive issue. It's the biggest stumbling block toward moving forward with the U.S.-China relationship of the resolution of the issue with Taiwan. Now, Jesse Helms talked about, and I think I might have mentioned we were here before, as we go through the Taiwan Relations Act, and then we have three joint communiques that elaborate on it, it gets into sort of legalistic descriptions of the relationship with Taiwan. Jesse Helms described it. He said, "You, Mr. Ambassador, when you go over there, you tell the Chinese leadership that we like the people of China. We want to get along with the people of China. We just don't want Taiwan to get kicked around." And I think in a North Carolina way, that pretty much says the U.S. view of how we view the situation with China. So how can we reconcile this? The one is the the issue of arms sales to Taiwan comes up year after year, and it is something that we need to look at carefully. But in my view, the guarantor of Taiwan's security, that they do not get kicked around, is the backing of the United States, not an individual weapon system. And so that's one side of that argument. The other side is, if we are serious about peaceful resolution, the things that lead us toward peaceful resolution are not doing things that exacerbate the tensions between China and between mainland China and the people of Taiwan, that don't exacerbate the tensions that exist there. So I've tried to say this in sort of plain language. There's a catechism you have to go through on the subject of China and Taiwan. But the way forward is one with dialogue. We say it is the issue for the people of China on both sides of the strait to solve. It's not our issue to solve. Our interest is that it be peaceful and that Taiwan not get kicked around. It is clear now Taiwan eventually will have to vote on this if there's to be a peaceful resolution. That's the mode of operation in Taiwan. And there has to be something that makes it attractive for China or attractive to the people of Taiwan to make that vote in a positive way. So there are some changes that need to occur both places. And I think if we can do some things, and I won't go into them here, but if there are some things that can be done that reduce the confrontation and allow some room for solutions, those are the areas where we should be looking.
Question in the same area. Do you believe China's saber-rattling against Taiwan will decrease after Taiwan's presidential election? Will Taiwan's new government actually begin mitigation talks that China will perceive to be sincere?
These are some questions that I really can't answer. When Taiwan makes the leaders in Taiwan make utterances about independence, and then the climate is worsened, and the folks in China start to do what some describe as saber rattling, because I think if you look at the domestic politics in China, there is no Chinese leader that can accept an independence type statements that emanate from Taiwan without some sort of response. I would like to think that whoever is elected in Taiwan, we hope that there is a way ahead. We've hoped that cross-strait dialogue will occur again, and I think this is we'll have to see how that turns out and who gets elected in Taiwan. It is again, it's not ours to say.
Do you care to comment on what role you expect U.S. and China relations to play in the fall election?
No.
If the press were here, they'd probably want to follow up on that, Mr. Ambassador, but we'll go on to the next question. What is the role of the Chinese-American community in helping or hindering an improved U.S.-China relationship? Could this role be improved?
I'm presuming this is the Chinese-American community in the U.S. That let me get back to a short story. When Jiang Zemin came on his first visit to the U.S., and his first stop was in Hawaii, and I was lucky enough to be his host when he came there. And we were riding out on the barge out to the Arizona Memorial, and we were looking at the Arizona Memorial, and he, after a little discussion, he looked at me and said, "Well, what are you up to, Admiral? What are you trying to do with the PLA? What is your objective here? And I said, well, we're trying to build a modicum of trust between us so that we can move ahead and have some communications and avoid inadvertent miscalculations or confrontations. And he said, well, you know, the people of China and the people of the United States are very, very different. We come from very different backgrounds, and before there can be any trust, there must be understanding. Well, that's sort of a simple statement, but I agree with it. The more I think about it, it's fairly profound. So I think the Chinese-American community, and some things have gone on with the Wenho Li case and some things like that that have been maybe not, well, certainly have not been beneficial and have created some stress in the Chinese-American community. And there may be some things that, as history goes along, maybe we'll find that things could have been done better. But we will see. But I think what the Chinese-American community can do, and the Committee of 100 and various other groups, is to work on promoting understanding between the people of China, the people of the U.S. There are a lot of things that go on. There are immense numbers of educational exchanges that go on, of which I was unaware. They are largely, by a factor of about 10 to 1, of Chinese coming to the U.S. versus going the other way. But I think educational exchanges and the promotion of those are a good thing. They're key to the future. That's planting, that's using seed corn for the future of this relationship. So I think things like that and cultural activities and just exchanging information and engaging in a lobbying sense, this has a kind of a, maybe I ought to retract that, but doing an advertising campaign sense of showing the good things about what is going on in China. And then the other part, that rather than try to market things and say things in ways that are just inoffensive, I think have as candid and straight a dialogue as we can possibly have. And if the subject is offensive, at least not have the manner be offensive and discuss these things straight up. And so I think that clear communication is a way the Chinese-American community can help, and it would be very welcome.
As a military expert, can you give us an assessment of the military balance of power between Taiwan and the PRC today and project that out 5 years?
Let me go back to the previous comment I made, is that if you look at the map of China and Taiwan, the guarantor of Taiwan's security is the relationship that exists in that area, and also for now, the backing of the United States, assuming China wanted to do something. Taiwan is small. If you look at I think if you just look at security in a military sense, which is a shallow way to look at security these days, where we have economic and political issues, the correct way to look at security is in a comprehensive security way, where there's an overlap between traditional military security, diplomatic or political strength, and economic security. You aren't going to get the military, sustained military security, without having a strong economy. Look at Russia. I mean, they overbalanced on military, and then it collapsed. You've got to have that three-legged milking stool effect of having some of each of those things. So Taiwan, you could not give Taiwan enough weaponry alone to maintain its security without the backing of the United States or without the goodwill of the mainland. So those are the issues, and so I think trying to go by a piece-by-piece military strength is sort of a futile effort and not very productive.
Mr. Ambassador, unfortunately, we've come to that time in our program when we have time for just one last question, and it is, your confirmation process went much smoother than many of the administration's recent appointments. Does that make it easier for you in working with Congress or the government of China?
I thank you for noticing. It didn't seem all that easy up close from time to time, but we tried to make it look easy. The fact is it does help. My background is one of – I've worked with the congressional committees for quite a while, and though I'm very irreverent about the inner workings of our Congress and I'm sometimes skeptical and seldom cynical, I actually have developed an increasing respect for the way it works, and I'd like to think that is mutual. I have I think is a good relationship with a number of members of Congress, and it makes it easier for me to work with them because I think I'm seen in another context than just an appointee from the administration, though they know who my boss is, and so do I.
On that note, our thanks to Ambassador Joseph Preer, U.S. Ambassador to China, for joining us today. We also thank our audience. Yes, please, let's give the ambassador a round. We also thank our audience here at the World Trade Center and those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the Asia Society, and the World Trade Club is adjourned.